Happy Memorial Day weekend, pumpkins. Today is May 27th, 2006, and this is the Weekly Roundup, a Mac Observer podcast. I'm Ricky Spiro. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/roundup. Lawyers, lawyers everywhere, and not a spot of ink. I usually avoid talking about litigation on the Roundup, but this week, I think it's time to breathe deep and dive in. Last October, a class action lawsuit was filed on behalf of Jason Tomczak against Apple Computer, claiming that the iPod Nano Surface scratches too easily. Now, Mr. Tomczak is offering a public letter claiming that the lawsuit was filed without his consent or knowledge. In the letter, Mr. Tomczak says that the law firm of David P. Meyer and Associates contacted him looking for insight into the nano scratching issue after he posted comments about his problem on the internet. He shared his experience with the law firm and also stated that he did not want to be involved in any legal actions. Later, Higgins Berman Sobel Shapiro LLP, the representative firm for David P. Meyer and Associates, filed the well-known class action. According to the letter, Mr. Tomczak never signed an attorney-client agreement. In response, Mr. Tomczak has filed suit against both the Higgins and Meyer firms, and both law firms have since filed countersuits against Mr. Tomczak. Now, since this show is about providing context, it seems only fair to point out that Higgins, Berman, Sobel, Shapiro got some additional coverage for alleged questionable practices. In addition to all of this iPod scratching business, the firm is also dealing with a suit brought against it by three bottled water companies. A jury has ordered the firm to pay $10.8 million U.S. in damages to the bottlers for allegedly damaging negotiations they were involved in with Nestle Waters and its Poland Spring brand. Now, this has nothing to do with technology news, but for someone like myself with no stake in all of this, it is kind of amusing. In this suit, the plaintiffs claim that the law firm was helping three water bottling companies in negotiations with Nestle Waters, which owns the Poland Spring brand, to settle a dispute over Poland Spring's use of the term natural spring water when it was actually pumping its water from wells. During the negotiations, Higgins, that's the law firm, jumped ship and filed class action claims in five states, causing Nestle to withdraw its settlement offer. A representative for the law firm claimed that the bottling companies were the ones that sold out for a quick profit. For links to all of the relevant documents in both of these cases, you can take a look at TMO's coverage through the show notes. Now, in case you needed more evidence that Americans are fond of litigation, the Recording Industry Association of America, our favorite, the RIAA, last week sued XM Radio over its new Eno device, which enables subscribers to the satellite service, that's XM Radio, to record content and bookmark particular songs they'd like to hear later. On Monday, representatives from both organizations squared off on a radio show, which is available on both XM and NPR. The question at hand is whether this device is simply used for time shifting, which is legally protected as a consumer right, or if it amounts to content downloading, or if it provides a content downloading system, for which XM would have to come to the content providers, that is, the record labels, to obtain permission. Is it too cynical of me to assume that permission would come with some sort of a price tag? Now, for the technology watchers out there, it's worth noting that this device, the Eno, works with the XM and Napster service, enabling subscribers to purchase songs they've bookmarked for $1 each. And very briefly now, the first reviews of MTV's new music service, Urge, are rolling in. A music service is made up of three things: the player, the jukebox, and the store. Think, for example, the iPod, iTunes, and the iTunes Music Store. CNET has reviewed a collection of three analogous pieces on the Windows Media side. Those would be Windows Media Player 11, iRivers Qlix Player, and MTV's Urge. CNET made the following claim: if you're looking for the Windows Media answer to iTunes and the iPod, this is it. Maybe WMA is getting its act together. We'll keep an eye on it. And here's a rather unusual type of story from this week. Pearson has agreed to purchase PowerSchool from Apple Computer. The deal terms were not disclosed, but Pearson does plan to develop iPod-compatible content for students and teachers. Pearson is the world's largest educational publisher and better known by its publishing brands, including Addison Wesley Professional, Adobe Press, and Peach Pit Press. PowerSchool, on the other hand, is a piece of software. It's an educational management system that provides real-time student performance feedback to teachers, parents, and students. Apple purchased PowerSchool in 2001 for $62 million in stock. Why is this story unusual? Well, we'll get into that in the context machine. SanDisk last weekend launched a website, idon't.com, that takes on the iPod by declaring, "The time has come to rise up against the iTatorship. Now is the time to break free from restrictive formats and a single source for music." iTatorship sounds kind of like a snack food to me. On a news page designed to resemble a blog, a SanDisk employee named Eric, who calls himself the Sheep Herder, refers to iPod owners as iSheep swarming through our cities. The site also pushes one really worthy alternative media player. That alternative, of course, is SanDisk's Sansa E200 MP3 player. While the site might at first glance seem simply like a website set up by a fan of SanDisk's products, or at least someone who doesn't like the iPod, the submissions policy page clearly states all comments shall be and remain SanDisk's property. Now that's comedy. Before we get into the context machine, I also wanted to say this week, I got some good feedback from last week's product roundup on Pandora. Some of you had already heard of it, and it was news to some of the rest of you. Robert, a New Yorker and music collector, was pretty psyched about Pandora. He also had some helpful hints on music discovery that I thought I'd pass along. He recommends some Paste Magazine podcasts, NPR's All Songs Considered, which is also available in podcast form, and shows from KEXP, which he calls the last great radio station in the U.S., and also KCRW. He gave one other good reminder: you can find a lot of music at your local public library. Robert raised one other good point. Someone out there should come up with a service that scans your iTunes directory, then makes recommendations based on what you already own. Think of it like AmigoFish, only for music, not podcasts. And if you don't know what AmigoFish is, take a listen to the roundup from March 20th. Thanks to everybody who wrote in. Keep those comments coming. I am listening. So joining me today, as often, is Jeff Gamet to help put some context around all of this, all these various legal lawyer stories, all kinds of stuff going on. Jeff, welcome to the show.
As always, it's wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with this iPod lawsuit, the screen scratching lawsuit. I'd been ignoring it largely, waiting to see if there was going to be any indicator from the court or elsewhere that this lawsuit had some merit. But this story was pretty bizarre, bizarre enough that I felt like we had to talk about it. What the heck is going on here with these two law firms and the guy who says, I didn't want to be involved in this case. What's happening here?
Well, first, you can't write soap operas this good. Real life, once again, is better than anything we could have made up. So what's going on with the whole thing? There's a law firm that had filed a class action lawsuit on the part of iPod Nano owners that claims that Apple knew that they were distributing a defective product, meaning a Nano that scratches too easily. The primary plaintiff that was listed in the case just came forward a few days ago saying, "Hey, I was never involved in this. I didn't want my name to be in the lawsuit, and I've been doing everything I can to get out of this." And now the law firm that filed the original suit has turned around and sued him because he is suing them, and it's turning into an interesting mess. I think ultimately Jason, the poor guy that's caught in the middle of all this, is going to be the real loser, because either he's stuck with lots of legal bills to protect himself, or he's potentially held liable for any losses that the law firm might have simply because he's not involved in the case and doesn't want to testify.
Now, this seems hard to believe. Is it really possible for someone to end up being the primary plaintiff in a case without wanting to be a plaintiff? I mean, you're the plaintiff. You're the one saying, I have a problem. If you just stand up and say, hey, I don't have a problem anymore, doesn't the case go away?
You would think. And you would also think that you couldn't have a case to begin with if the person never even wanted to be involved, which is exactly what's happened in this situation. Jason didn't want to be involved, and the law firm that brought the class action suit forward never had an agreement or a contract with him. And they went back after the fact to try and get him to sign something, and he wouldn't.
Now, we've read this letter that Jason Tomczak wrote about all of this. It's worth asking the question, who do we believe here? Who are we more inclined to believe? Is there a reason for us to believe that the stuff in this letter from Mr. Tomczak is really a proper telling of the events?
You know, I'm kind of inclined to side with Jason on this one. And that comes from having actually contacted the law firm that's representing him and getting confirmation from them as well. And of course, they have a vested interest in saying what he is saying is correct. However, I've also seen the case filing, and it's like a soap opera, really. But I just have a feeling, based on the fact that the original law firm also has acknowledged that they went back to try and get him to sign a legal document, says that Jason is telling us the truth. So, yeah, we'll just have to see what happens.
Yeah. So there are some good reasons to believe that's really what's going on. And a law firm generally is not going to say, is not necessarily going to defend their client if their client is saying things that totally don't jibe with reality. Of course, we would think that would be true of the law firm Sobel Shapiro, or Hagens, as I've been calling it earlier in the show. We'd think that everyone would pretty much be saying, look, this is what's going on. It's hard to believe that a law firm would push a case when they don't have a primary plaintiff actually involved in it. Is there any one other question about this? Is there any way that you can imagine reading this story where Hagens doesn't come out looking, or David Meyer and Associates don't end up looking sleazy?
You know, I have a pretty vivid imagination, and I'm coming up blank on that one. I just don't see him coming out smelling like roses at all.
All right. Let's move on to talk about this XM device. Eno, I believe it's called. In your opinion, based on what you've read, is this a time-shifting device, or is it a music player?
I think the easiest way to describe this would be TiVo for satellite radio. And it's a perfect analogy. It works exactly the same way. So it's a time-shifting recording type device, because if you don't record, you can't time shift. Mm-hmm. And it's a music player in the same sense that TiVo is a cable or television player. It passes that information through and either records it or not, depending on whether or not you want to time shift.
All right. Now, it sounds, from what you're saying, like this pretty solidly fits in the time-shifting category, which is how most people view TiVo, as opposed to the iPod, where you can pick and choose what things go on it, and you can pick and choose how long they stay there, and you can pick and choose what you want to listen to at any given point in time.
Right.
Based on all of those things, knowing that time-shifting is a protected right, it's a pretty solidly protected right in the courts, Can we confidently predict who's going to end up on top in this squabble between the labels and XM?
No, but that's only because we're dealing with legal issues, and no one knows what's going to happen until it finally does. However, if I were a betting man, I would bet in favor of XM, because this device seems to be so clearly a time-shifting TiVo-style product as opposed to an iPod-style product.
So if, in fact, the ruling were to come out in favor of the RIAA in this one, we'd probably be back on this show saying, what happened here? How did this happen?
Oh, absolutely. I would be very surprised if this one goes in favor of the RIAA.
All right. Now, there's one other thing before we begin here. You were mentioning that there was some interesting breaking news. We're recording this on a Friday afternoon. Some news that just came down relating to Apple in another legal case. I haven't talked about it at all, but why don't you give us the setup here, Jeff?
Okay, the nickel rundown is that the Electronic Frontier Foundation announced mere minutes ago that a ruling has been released in the lawsuit where Apple has sued to get source information from online journalists. And the journalist said, no, I'm not going to give you that. The courts ruled in favor of the online journalists and the EFF, which is certainly a win for journalism and free speech in the United States.
So it sounds like this is a ruling that you're pleased to see come along.
Yes, I'm very pleased, because had this gone in favor of Apple, we would have had a potential situation where, if you take it to the extreme, we have corporations dictating what is journalism and what isn't, ultimately controlling what is free speech and what isn't. And that's not what we want.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, what was going on here was Apple was saying, look, this website, and was it Think Secret? Was that the website in question here?
And O'Grady's Power Page, and there was one other, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who that was.
So these websites, Apple was saying, published trade secrets of ours. They said these trade secrets are critical to our competitive advantage, and if I'm not mistaken, it was for some audio FireWire breakout box that they never released called Asteroid. Is this the right thing still?
That's exactly right.
All right. So, and they said, look, these are our trade secrets. If they get out before we're ready to release them, then that's a big problem for us. And so therefore, we have a right to protect our non-disclosure agreements and our trade secrets by going after people that publish that information before we say they can. And I think a widely held belief, certainly among online journalists, was, well, you're only going after these people because they are online journalists. If the Wall Street Journal had published it, you wouldn't be suing them. And so the one of the critical questions here is, how do you treat online journalists relative to the rest of journalism in the world?
Right. And in this case, the Supreme Court said you treat all journalists exactly the same.
And this is the Supreme Court of California or of the United States?
This is where I'll have a brief moment of ignorance. I'm not sure. I would have to go back and double check.
All right. Well, by the time we get an article up about that, I'm sure we'll have those details straightened out. But it is good that, you know, I always said we don't break news on this show, but it is nice to have some actual breaking news on a podcast. Hey, cheers.
Excellent.
Let's talk about one more thing before we head out of here. Let's talk about PowerSchool. Apple, pretty rarely, compared to a lot of other firms in the $10 billion revenue club, Apple pretty rarely purchases firms. The only other one I can think of off the top of my head in the last few years was eMagic, which they bought in order to get Logic, and which allowed them to create GarageBand and some other things.
Right.
But Apple pretty rarely purchases companies. It bought PowerSchool in 2001. It's even more rare to watch Apple sell off what it's already bought, what it already controls. And that, of course, it dovetails very well with Apple's competitive strategy of, as Steve Jobs says, controlling the whole widget, of having a vertically integrated system where you just say, look, we make the hardware, the software, we make all kinds of other stuff that runs on top of our computers, which is why everything works together so well. So it's very rare to see them give up control of something that they have control of already. What's going on here? Why would Apple relinquish control of PowerSchool?
Well, now, keep in mind I'm speculating here, but it looks to me like Apple is not exactly relinquishing control. They're just moving the product somewhere else where they can control it in a different way. And the company that's buying it, Pearson, their educational publishing company, huge publisher, they deal with the educational market all the time. So I have a feeling that Apple is looking at this as a good fit to continue promoting the product and feed it back into the whole iPod market at the same time, because Pearson will be producing podcasts that go along with the software. I have a feeling that Apple has something else in store that none of us know about yet. And when they finally release whatever that is, we'll sit back and go, okay, well, that totally makes sense why they moved PowerSchool over to Pearson.
Now, do you think that they're, would you, again, this is speculation, but is your impression that they're creating something that would compete with PowerSchool, or that they want to develop something that would help promote PowerSchool as software, but is something, I mean, my reading of this is more, they're looking, PowerSchool was too much of a peripheral thing for them to support, and they figure, hey, Pearson is more equipped to do the podcast and do all the supplementary stuff that we want other people to do with our software. So we're going to let them take care of that and develop it and allow it to grow. And we're just going to worry about more core technologies. Are you thinking that they want to create something to compete with PowerSchool, or that they just want to focus more on their core technologies?
I think they want to focus more on the core technologies, but I think along with that core technology, they have something in store that will be a complementary component to PowerSchool. And it may be nothing more than enhancing the iTunes University product, where, for those people that don't know, it's a system that universities can use that ties directly into iTunes, and then you use iTunes to be able to download the lectures from your school, different activities at the school that are recorded. It's sort of like an online repository for everything at your school.
And the other version of this that I can imagine, for example, Apple has created complementary software. A lot of people see Aperture, which is a photo management kind of like iPhoto on steroids software that a lot of people have said pairs very nicely with Adobe's Photoshop. It's a library for photos and a way to do some basic photo management, but if you really want to edit your photos, you're going to have to open up Photoshop. Do you think that they have something in that area more of interest to them?
They may very well, and for all I know, they might have something lined up where they're going to start a system where you can have your curriculum online in a complementary fashion to the services PowerSchool provides, which is the whole tracking of all your students in real time so that everyone, the parents and teachers and other faculty, know what's going on.
Which would be quite interesting to see.
Which would be quite interesting, yes.
And I think that's going to have to do it for this week. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Well, sure. I love coming on.
Cheers. If you have questions or thoughts about the news, send me an email at roundup@macobserver.com. We'll hit the usual product roundup before I head out. Nike and Apple on Tuesday introduced the $30 Nike and iPod Sport Kit, a receiver-sensor combination that works with compatible Nike footwear to deliver real-time audible feedback to an iPod Nano while the user exercises. Time, distance, calories burned, and pace are all stored on the iPod and displayed on its screen, as well as spoken through the headphones. After working out, users connect the MP3 player to their computer and automatically sync and store data using a service on the Nike website. When setting up their playlists, users can select a power song that will be activated when they press the iPod Nano's center button. The idea is that the power song will give them the extra boost they need to complete their workout. Now, Nike's new $100 Air Zoom Moir shoes, I don't know if that's how it's said, but I felt like saying it like that, are the first ones to work with the sport kit, The new products will be available in stores on July 13th. I will say the web service Nike has set up, which you can find through the article at the show notes, is pretty interesting. It lets you, for example, challenge fellow runners around the world to virtual races. That's in case you have no analog friends to run with. Otherworld Computing on Wednesday introduced 1GB and 2GB RAM upgrade kits for MacBook and MacBook Pro owners. The 1GB version is $109, and the 2GB version is $250. Otherworld also released a line of FireWire RAID arrays with storage up to 750GB and prices up to $1,220. Miglia Technology announced the immediate availability of TV Max for the Mac Mini. TV Max is an analog TV recorder. It fits underneath the Mini, lets you watch TV in window mode or full screen, connects to converts VHS tapes to DVD, exports to iPod, and includes an infrared remote. TV Max is priced at $250. And here's something life-changing. Programmer Ian Anthony has created a handy little utility called Mac Saber, which uses a MacBook or MacBook Pro's motion sensor to create lightsaber sounds as the hardware's owner swings the computer through the air. It gauges the speed of the swinging to determine the lightsaber movement sounds and senses the acceleration to produce different levels of striking effects. If any of you pansies out there are too squeamish to wave around your laptop, you can simply download the utility and move its window around your Mac screen to get the same effect. Unsurprisingly, videos of Mac owners playing with the software have already begun popping up on YouTube. And that's the news. Thanks for listening to the Weekly Roundup. Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by CashFly. And the bass is by Boom for TMO. Have a great long weekend, everybody. Stay subscribed. Until next week, I'll see you online.